From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. A third COVID-19 vaccine is on its way to health clinics today after the CDC approved over the weekend Johnson & Johnson's application for emergency use. The company is promising to deliver 20 million doses by the end of March, with shots beginning as soon as tomorrow in some states. For more on what this means for the overall vaccination effort, let's bring in Dr. Amesh Adalja. He's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health and Security. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine differs from the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines already in use because it only requires one shot and can be stored in a refrigerator. How big of a deal is this approval?
It's a major big deal. This is a vaccine that is much easier to give because, like you said, it doesn't require very strenuous cold storage, and it's a single dose vaccine. It's one and done. So you don't have to have all that consternation about second dose scheduling and missing your second dose or delaying your second dose. All of that evaporates with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So this is an exciting development in the war on COVID.
So far, more than 75 million doses have been administered here in the U.S., but there are still major concerns about supply and distribution. How far is this third approval actually going to solve those problems?
It eventually will be a major part of the solution, but right now, over the next couple of months, it's not going to probably have a major impact. There's probably about 3.9 million doses that are going to be delivered this week, and then it's going to take some time to ramp up. So we won't see a major surge in vaccinations just because of this in the short term. But as we get further along, I do think that this vaccine, along with the others, Pfizer, Moderna, plus a few others that are waiting in the wings, such as the AstraZeneca and Novavax vaccine, are going to get us to herd immunity. But we're going to get benefits even before then. We're already starting to see benefits with nursing home cases and deaths going down. As we get our vulnerable populations protected, you're going to see less pressure on hospitals. We won't be worrying about hospital capacity. We'll have basically tamed the virus from the ability to cause serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And I think that's going to usher in a wave of optimism, as well as allow a lot more flexibility and social distancing recommendations.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the efficacy of this Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Some people have actually shared concerns that it might be less effective, but clinical trials for those vaccines were conducted differently than some of the others. Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
I think people need to get vaccinated as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. And if I would go to a place where they had J&J, I would have no hesitancy whatsoever to take it.
Okay, is he right? Are those shots all equally good? Does it actually matter which one you get?
No, it doesn't matter which one you get. They are all equally good when it comes to what matters. And what matters is serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And they all are tremendous when it comes to those outcomes. And that's the whole reason why we actually developed a vaccine against COVID-19, because we were trying to defang it, make it unable to cause the serious illness that brought it to our attention, and make it more like other respiratory viruses that we deal with on a year-in and year-out basis. COVID's not going to be eliminated. It's not going to go away. But what we're going to do is remove its ability to cause serious disease and compromise hospital capacity. It's also important to remember, don't compare the vaccines like apples to apples, because they were in multiple different trials. They were never studied head to head, and they were all done at different timelines and different parts of the world. So you can't really look at these numbers and say, oh, this number is bigger than this number, therefore this vaccine is better, when you're looking at symptomatic disease or those efficacy numbers people keep throwing around. So just get whatever vaccine is available to you, and it will be the path to you reclaiming your life and the world ending this pandemic.
You know, we mentioned the Johnson & Johnson vaccine requires only the one shot and doesn't need this extra cold storage. And at least one CDC reviewer this weekend said those features specifically might actually make it easier to vaccinate groups disproportionately affected by the pandemic, including people with limited access to health care and people who live in rural areas. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do, because you can take a vaccine like this and put it very near the population. You don't have to have people getting vaccinated at a place where they have cold storage. You also don't necessarily have to have that 15-minute waiting period, because we saw some allergic reactions after the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine. So this is something you could really roll out in a mass vaccination manner, in a way that could even include mobile units that go door to door. This can really be used more like a traditional vaccine. And I do think it's going to be important for rural populations where they may not have a place to get vaccinated, or people that are that can't take the time off from work to schedule or don't have the time to do all of that. All of that makes it much easier when you have a single dose vaccine like this. You're one and done and you can go about your life. I think that that's a real huge advantage in the United States, and it will also be so in the world.
The number of new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has fallen to about where it was in October. We just recently received that news, down drastically from this peak we saw in early January. But today, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said she's concerned that the number of new cases appears to have leveled off instead of continuing to decrease. Are you actually worried where the pandemic goes from here?
I want to get a little bit more information. We've had about a week or so of data. I'd like to see probably 2 weeks of data to see if this is really a slowing of the decline or a plateauing that's occurred. But clearly, we are plateauing. If we are plateauing at 70,000 cases a day, that's still a lot. But I would just caveat that with the fact that if we can get our vulnerable populations protected, nursing home residents, community dwelling people with high risk conditions, we're much less concerned about that number of cases. At least I'm not, but I am, because it's not going to be something that can threaten hospital capacity again, because our people who get hospitalized, like nursing home residents, have been vaccinated so heavily. I think it's important to remember we're not going to get to COVID zero. I don't know what level this we're going to eventually plateau to, but the virus is still going to be around years from now. It's just not going to be able to cause disease. So we have to figure out where that place is going to be, that set point. And I think the one variable that's likely driving the CDC's concern is the fact that there are these more contagious variants out there, and we're trying to stay ahead of them. But the way to stay ahead of them is to continue doing what we're doing with the face masks and wearing and washing your hands and avoiding crowded and congregated places, but to greatly accelerate vaccination programs. We can't have vaccines sitting on shelves, and we know some states still have vaccine on shelves.
Dr. Amish Adalja is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As a new vaccine option promises some relief for beleaguered rollout efforts, the Senate this week takes up a nearly $2 trillion economic relief package. The bill passed the House early Saturday morning, but by a narrow margin and with no Republican support. For the latest on negotiations, we're joined by NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Sue, House Democrats wanted a $15 minimum wage in the bill, but the Senate's nonpartisan parliamentarian determined the wage hike couldn't be included under the rules of budget reconciliation, which is the process Democrats are using. So now some liberal Democrats want to push businesses to increase wages themselves. What's the latest on that front?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to be likely. What Democrats had said, and again, all Democrats supported the $15 minimum wage, like you said, they're just using a process that isn't going to allow for it. Democrats did say they would look for other ways to advance the wage. The House is likely to pass a standalone minimum wage increase, although, again, that's going to hit a familiar Senate roadblock with the filibuster. But what Senate Democrats had immediately said is they would look at maybe changing the tax code, saying that big corporations that don't pay their workers a certain amount of wages could face tax penalties. They've backed away from that. We haven't seen the final decision, but sources tell us that they're unlikely to include that for a couple of reasons. One, it's a bit complicated. We're not entirely sure how they would implement that in the tax code. And even if it's an idea that sounds good to a lot of Democrats, there was some real reluctance into rushing in some kind of major tax code change in just days without the chance to kind of give it a more thorough review to see how it would work or any potential unintended consequences, like would make major corporations shift full-time workers into contractors to avoid skirting those kind of rules. So it's on pause for now, even if the idea itself is still pretty popular with a lot of Democrats.
I see a lot of Democrats, but the wage hike could have run into some fracturing within the Democratic Senate. And all 50 Democratic senators probably do need to sign on to this bill for it to pass, because it's unlikely to get any Republican support. So what are Senate Democrats still working out to reach a consensus, Sue?
Yeah, I mean, the irony here is saying that the wage can't be in the bill probably made it easier to get it through the Senate. There was a couple of Democrats, certainly more moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who were skeptical about that wage increase. And without it in it, you know, this bill's probably on a glide path to passing in the Senate. I don't think that any Democrat is really interested in denying Joe Biden of a major win in his first 100 days in office. And on the whole, Democrats support the policies in this bill. As you said, it's likely headed towards a 50-50 vote. Vice President Kamala Harris will probably have to break the tie. There's no indication that we're going to get any Republican support for this bill, although I think Democrats knew that from the very beginning, and that's why they chose to use a process that wouldn't need Republicans in the first place.
So what are the Republican objections then, if it looks like zero are going to sign on?
Well, they would say that a lot of this bill isn't about COVID-19 relief. And in a lot of ways, they're right. You know, they'll also say that Democrats are using this legislation to try to advance policies that they wanted to promote long before the pandemic. In a lot of ways, they're right. You know, Democrats probably wouldn't even argue with those attacks. Democrats are trying this. This is really all about economic relief. There's a lot of things in there, like the stimulus checks, extended unemployment benefits, and a new interesting policy that Democrats are trying to use that would give sort of like a experiment and universal basic income, that it would change the tax code to allow for monthly payments to people for parents who have dependents at home. And Democrats say this could be one of the best advancements of eliminating child poverty. So, yeah, there's a lot of things in here that are Democratic policies. The thing is that a lot of these policies are really popular with the public. So Democrats are looking at bipartisan as how the country views it, not necessarily how Republicans view it.
And they're saying Republicans will get what they want, maybe more than they want. That's NPR's Susan Davis. Thanks, Sue.
Gaye's record, What's Going On, came out around this time 50 years ago. Unemployment was at 6%, an all-time high. People were protesting police brutality, and Americans were angry over the Vietnam War. What's Going On reflected those times with laser-sharp precision, and it's gone on to become Motown's biggest commercial success. And 50 years later, we're still into it. That's because themes from What's Going On reflect some of the most significant challenges and divisions we face as a society. For more on the importance of What's Going On 50 years later, we're joined by music journalist, author, and cultural critic Nelson George, who interviewed Gaye during his lifetime. Nelson, welcome to Here and Now.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, well, you know, many folks might actually be surprised to learn that this album almost wasn't made. Motown founder Berry Gordy was actually afraid it would ruin Gaye's career. In hindsight, that seems kind of hard to believe, but why was there so much pushback from Gordy?
Well, I mean, Motown was not a company that was built on any kind of personal statements. It was the superb production line with producers, a great band, the Funk Brothers, who created pop music for, as they said, the sound of young America. You know, that kind of political, social, personal work was not a signature of the company.
Ronaldo Obeas, as he was called, Benson of the Four Tops, actually wrote this song after, during a tour stop in Berkeley, California, he saw a scuffle with police and protesters at this anti-Vietnam War protest. Let's listen to a little of the words.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality.
Nelson, Marvin agreed to record the song, but he removed the question mark at the end of the title. Why did he do that?
It wasn't a question, it was a statement, in a sense, you know, and the record itself tries to actually provide answers. When I say that, I mean to say that spirituality, brotherhood, you know, the oneness of man, ideas that people talked about a lot in the 60s, and quite honestly, is not being talked about enough now in the 21st century. So the album not only illustrates the challenges, but also speaks to what he thinks are solutions. So I don't think you need a question mark for that. It was a statement. What's going on? And here are some of the answers.
Yeah. You know, What's Going On has been used throughout the world in demonstrations against totalitarian regimes. A call for peace in the Middle East. BLM activists played it during protests more recently. It's often played on hand drums at Native American powwows. When did it become clear that Marvin Gaye had this enduring hit that was really bigger than anything that he had ever done before then?
Well, the record, you know, was an immediate success. And it was a huge cultural moment. So it definitely resonated in its time. But ultimately, the world came back to this album. And I think that's one of the things that happened in the last few years with all the turmoil over race relations, the entire chaos and the fragmentation. People talking about, you know, climate change. Will climate change He's talking about the ecology in 1971. These are all ideas and conversations we're having right now in 2021 that Marvin was having. And so the themes of the album have proved to be enduring.
The second song on the album, What's Happening, Brother, was written for Gaye's brother, Frankie, who had just returned from a 3-year tour in Vietnam and was struggling to find a job. Let's listen.
Just getting back, but you knew I would. Boys head up. When will it be?
You know, to put this in context, the American people were learning in 1971 through the Pentagon Papers how the U.S. government had basically lied to them about the Vietnam War. And this song spoke exactly to the sentiment of hundreds of thousands of Americans impacted by loved ones serving in the war. What do you hear when you listen to this song?
Well, I don't just hear it, I see it. What I'm seeing is I was a child. I was probably maybe 11 or 12 or 13 in 71. And there were all these brothers in New York who were wearing those jackets, the jackets that Army guys wore when they came back. Mm-hmm. And they were around on the corner. They were scuffling, trying to find work. They were at the barbershop you went to. So you had this return of all these brothers who had been in the war, and they weren't celebrated. You know, there was a lot of protest about the war, so it wasn't like the World War II people where everyone was patting them on the back. So that sense of displacement, disillusionment, the feeling of being used by the government as cannon fodder. That's what when I hear that song in particular, I don't just hear it, I see these people that I remember seeing in the streets, and the song reflects that sense of confusion and sadness.
Mm-hmm. Mercy, Mercy Me, the ecology, is a popular one from the album. It was written solely by Gaye, and it's a direct truth-telling about the way we impact our environment. Let's listen to a little.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh.
Nelson, this song rose to number 4 on the Billboard Pop Singles chart and even had a rare appearance for Marvin on the Adult Contemporary charts. You brought up this song a little bit earlier, but you know what always gets me is the end with that haunting soprano voice. What about you?
Mm. The sound of the record embraces many traditions. That was almost like a choral, churchy, even European churchy thing, not necessarily just a Black churchy thing. So when you listen to this record, there's just the inherent spiritual dimension. There's also this jazz thing that's constantly flowing through the percussion, and how percussion plays a huge part in the flow of this particular song and the entire album. So by layering in organically so many different kinds of music, you create an environment that is very distinctive. This album really changed Marvin's career.
You interviewed Marvin Gaye a few times, mm-hmm. but there's the time in March of 1983, a year before he was killed by his father. And you were met with a man who was different than what you expected him to be. He was a visibly broken man. And you wrote this highly regarded but very haunting piece. All these years later, do you interpret that interview and the man before you any differently?
Well, no, I mean, that was a moment, you know, he was coming back from his kind of self-imposed exile in Europe. When he came back to the States, he was on a high, sexual healing was coming out and he was sort of on a comeback. But he also was confronting his old demons, demons of drug abuse, demons of very fraught family relations, demons of his own sexual issues that he was dealing with. And so I feel like there's a sense of, melancholy. When I sat with him, I asked him about what's going on and whether or not the time called for another album like that. And he was very reluctant to sort of embrace that idea. He said it took a lot of soul searching, a lot of meditation. So he wasn't in whatever space that had created what's going on had passed for him. He had moved away from the social commentary that what's going on represented. And I think it's because he spiritually didn't feel connected both to the U.S. in the same way and even to some parts of his own views.
We asked some of our listeners what this album means to them, especially now during the pandemic and with so much pain and suffering. And Jonathan Grunert of Rochester, New York, told us he first heard What's Going On as he worked his way through his college CD library almost 20 years ago. He's 38 now and makes a point of listening to the album every year.
Most recently, I've listened to it as I drove to Rochester for Black Lives Matter demonstrations around the 2020 murder of Daniel Prude, pointing out to my kids that this album, nearly 50 years old, is still very relevant and very real, and a cry for help, healing, and understanding in the face of unspeakable violence.
Nelson, it's been 50 years since this album debuted. What does it mean to you?
Well, it's just, to me, a beautiful piece of art. Inner City Blues haunts me. There's something about the production and sound of it. I mean, you could put that music over any city scene in any urban center in the last 50 years, and that music would work. Mm-hmm. The descriptions in it, the atmosphere of the record, his vocal stylings, it would still feel like he's describing right now.
Music journalist, author, filmmaker, and cultural critic Nelson George, thank you so much for going down memory lane with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This album means a lot to a lot of you. Here's some of what else you all had to say. Charles Townsend, 62, of New York City, says, "It was the first album I bought with my own money as a church kid. It was the first popular music I heard that was both spiritual and secular, that I could dance to, and it made it practically divine. I had to have it." Chelsea Crabb of Somerville, Massachusetts, says she's always loved Marvin Gaye since she was a kid, but now at 26 years old, she says, "I finally know what Marvin Gaye's lyrics really mean and really meant. I finally know what he was singing about, pleading for, exactly 50 years ago, the cyclical patterns of history writing itself in another repeat measure right on time." Thanks to all of you who sent in messages going down memory lane with us, the 50th anniversary year of Marvin Gaye's seminal album, What's Going On. This is Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
Protesters turned out again today in Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, in defiance of security forces that fired into crowds of protesters yesterday. Sunday was the bloodiest day in Myanmar since the military seized power there 1 month ago. Michael Sullivan has been covering this story for NPR from Thailand, and he joins us now for more. Michael, the United Nations Human Rights Office says at least 18 people were killed in Myanmar yesterday. Tell us more about what happened.
Well, in the past month, Myanmar's new military ruler showed uncharacteristic restraint for such a brutal institution, one that's been accused of genocide and ethnic cleansing in its treatment of the ethnic minority Rohingya. But yesterday morning, they went all in, I think. It was just nasty. Riot police and some military units were out in force all over the country, in the biggest city, Yangon, in the second city, Mandalay, and other cities, and they didn't hold back. Tear gas, rubber bullets, live rounds against protesters who seemed a little taken aback from the video I watched at how quickly and violently things turned. And those videos and photos were pretty graphic. Bloodied protesters being dragged away to safety by their friends, and more wounded cowering in buildings in and around the protest sites. It wasn't pretty.
Yeah, it was quite a scene, as you say. And I'm curious now, Michael, because it's been a month since this military coup. They claimed election fraud without evidence, and military leaders initially had promised new elections. So have they actually offered a date for that or provided any sort of concessions to democracy? Or do you get the sense, particularly from yesterday's violence, that the situation could just escalate and continue to get worse?
I would have to go with the situation's going to get worse. Initially, they said they were imposing a state of emergency for a year, which implied that they were going to have new elections in a year. But since then, they've been very quiet on that subject. And honestly, I don't see much hope that this is going to get resolved peacefully. After yesterday's violence, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said there would be additional actions to impose further costs on those responsible for yesterday's violence and the coup. But if the U.S. can't get its regional allies on board, it's tough to see diplomacy working. Japan and Singapore are two of the biggest investors in Myanmar, and even though they're both allies, there's a lot at stake economically, yeah? So if the U.S. can't get them on board, I don't think Myanmar's military will loosen its hold. They haven't been afraid of sanctions in the past. I don't think they will be now, though I think it's been clear from just how big these demonstrations have been that the military has overreached, or at least underestimated, how much they are reviled by the general population.
One other notable development today is that the lawyer for the ousted leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, says she's facing new criminal charges. And she appeared in court via video, and this is the first time she's been seen since she was detained a month ago. So, Michael, what else do we know about her status?
Not a lot. In the beginning, she was apparently detained in her house in the capital, Naypyidaw, but now we're not sure. Her lawyer, as you just said she appeared today in court in the capital and was charged with her third alleged offense since the February 1st coup. This one was for inciting unrest. That's on top of the first two charges she faces already, wait for it, for illegally importing walkie-talkies and for defying a public order limiting public gatherings due to the coronavirus pandemic. It's pretty obvious the military is trying to lay the groundwork for keeping her from running for public office again, even if they give up power again.
That's reporter Michael Sullivan with the latest from Myanmar after the bloodiest day since the military coup a month ago. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
Two women have now come forward alleging sexual harassment by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Yesterday, Governor Cuomo issued an apology, saying his comments to former aides could have, quote, been misinterpreted as an unwanted flirtation. And under pressure, he also agreed to an independent investigation with subpoena power. NPR's Sally Herships has been following the story and joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, Sally. Let's start with the two women, former aides, who have raised these claims against the governor, Lindsay Boylan and Charlotte Bennett. What do we know about them, and what exactly are they alleging?
So Lindsay Boylan is a former aide. She is now running for Manhattan Borough president. And she had first come out and accused the mayor of sexual harassment in December on Twitter. But at the time, she said she wouldn't talk to the press. So more recently, she published this post on Medium claiming that when she'd been working for his administration, Cuomo had sexually harassed her. He's since denied the allegations. She says he suggested they play strip poker, that he kissed her on the mouth. And her post includes these screenshots of texts with her mom from the time. And her mom says, he is a sexist pig and you should avoid being alone with him. Then we have woman number two, Charlotte Bennett. She is 25. She was an executive assistant for the Cuomo administration, and she left in the fall. And the New York Times is reporting that she says Cuomo asked her if she thought age made a difference in romantic relationships and whether she ever had sex with older men. But a third person has come forward. This is Lindsay Nielsen, and she tweeted yesterday, I have something to say. This is a slightly different allegation. She was a TV journalist in Albany covering the mayor, and she wrote a Twitter post explaining that the governor was bullying her, so that she was getting these late night phone calls and threats to call her boss and, you know, like kind of attempts to intimidate her into not doing stories. And she says this ultimately made her quit her job.
Wow. So it's a rapidly evolving story. And as I mentioned, Governor Cuomo said yesterday that he's open to an independent investigation and will grant subpoena power to whomever New York Attorney General Letitia James picks to lead the investigation. And that's kind of a turnaround because a week ago, the governor had initially selected federal judge Barbara Jones to conduct a review. Remind us, Sally, why that was not well received and what maybe prompted the governor to change his mind.
Sure. So New York State Legislative staffers have a group, some past staffers. It's called the Sexual Harassment Working Group. And I spoke with one of the co-founders last week, and she pointed out that when sexual harassment happens at the hands of a politician, it can be especially ugly. And that's because politicians have a lot of power. They appoint judges. They appoint police chiefs. So her group and lots of others have been calling for an independent investigation. And the idea that he could appoint or somehow be in charge of the investigation did not go over so well.
And, you know, after he initially earned praise for his pandemic management, Sally, Governor Cuomo is now facing a lot of scrutiny for his management, including a federal probe into his administration's intentional undercounting of nursing home COVID-19 deaths. So that's the backdrop of these allegations against him. In the moment that we have left, does he have any political support left to weather this?
Oh, wow. You know, this guy loves a good press conference. He hasn't had one in days, I think perhaps even a week. This is a really serious threat. What's really telling here, Scott Stringer, one of the Democratic mayoral candidates who had come out, you know, and sort of touted the importance of a good working relationship between the New York City mayor and governor, had posted his own statement on Twitter this weekend saying the behavior of these two women, you know, the way it was described, is disgusting and absolutely unacceptable. He also supports an independent investigation. And if their allegations are found to be correct, then Cuomo should resign. This is a serious threat, bottom line.
So a lot to watch for in the coming days. NPR's Sally Herships, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Colorado now and the fight to stop wildfires. More than 6 million homes throughout the country are at significant risk from fires. And for the most part, it's up to residents to work together to protect their homes. But conversations about cutting down beloved trees in a neighborhood can be tough. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis reports on how some homeowners in Colorado are trying to cooperate to improve safety.
As Shelley Olson walks around the charred rubble of what was her Grand Lake home, she points to a pile of things that survived one of the largest wildfires in state history.
You can see my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law piled all of my silver for my grandmother. We just kind of did some digging. All the silver was right around here, so dining room area.
Olson is the assistant chief for Grand Fire Protection District 1, and for the last 10 years, she's focused her work on helping communities protect themselves from flames. She even formed a group to educate residents on what to do.
I didn't think it would happen to me. No. Like, EMTs are really bad patients. Like, nurses and doctors, we're really bad patients. It's like that. You know, we're so good at speaking about it and telling everyone else, and then do we always take our own advice? You know, it's like, I don't know.
Olson does believe that the work she did around her home to try and prevent it from burning down would have worked if the East Troublesome Fire had behaved like a normal fire. But it didn't. It exploded in a single night. Residents had minutes to evacuate.
We accepted the risk to live in the woods. And so we have to do everything we can to be adaptive to living in the woods. But when a firestorm like this comes through, it's like, what could we have done? But you have to keep spreading the word. Wildfire is not going away.
Climate change likely means more fires, and with more people living in risky areas, mitigation becomes more important. Individuals can do a lot, but if a neighbor hasn't cleared dead material, kept the lawn green and trimmed, and cut down some trees, it leaves all the homes near it at risk. But working together can be hard. Hannah Brinkert-Smith is an associate research professor at the University of Colorado Boulder.
There are some people who are going to do it and some people who aren't. But there's a lot that can shift in a community, and what we want to do is understand how and why, and can that knowledge be leveraged?
Brinkert-Smith works with a team of social scientists and wildfire practitioners, like Shelley Olson, to help their efforts, which she says are worth it.
We're spending so much money on suppression. Firefighters are putting their lives at risk when we could be investing instead at the front end of the problem. And at that front end, actions by human beings are the key to reducing risk.
The Wildfire Research Center analyzes data from different states and in every place they've worked.
When people report that they've talked with their neighbor about wildfire risk, they have reported doing more risk mitigation.
That's why the Leading Wildfire Preparedness Program requires a local resident to take the lead on getting their neighborhood prepared.
And then they go and connect with those neighbors and help them identify the risks because they're a known figure.
That's Megan Fitzgerald McGowan, a program specialist with FireWise USA.
They're not scary. They're not the government. They're your neighbor.
The FireWise program is run by the National Fire Protection Association, which has done years of research on what helps to keep a home from burning down. They've found that it's not usually a wall of flames that destroys a building. Instead, embers will land on a nearby tree or a pile of dead leaves or whatever is stuck in the gutters. When that catches fire, the home can be next, and then the next.
It's kind of like that idea of herd immunity. Your property can impact my property and maybe that person across the street. And if we all work together to reduce that shared risk, we improve our overall situation.
In the mountain town of Silverthorne, Lisa Kendall and Doug Spainhauer are caretakers of a private subdivision. They live here, and the Homeowners Association hires them to do work around the property. 20 years ago,
this whole ranch looked completely different. There was dense forest, the whole ranch was. So all the people that lived here, that's what they were used to. They didn't take into consideration the fact that it was basically a tinderbox.
Doug and Lisa were concerned for their community, so they started talking to their neighbors about doing FireWise work. At first, it didn't look promising.
Just that initial angst over, oh, you want to cut live trees, why? It took a little while for people to digest that having a live tree right near your home, that equates to more risk to your house burning down.
Once they started doing the work, the homeowners realized the benefits.
It's easier to walk through. It's easier to ride the horses through. There's a lot more wildlife. It's not such a bad thing to not have so many trees around us anymore.
And the growing threat of wildfire has motivated the community to keep up the work. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sackis.
Texas is still in recovery mode, 2 weeks after that extreme icy weather left millions without power, heat, and in many cases, water for several days. One of the most heartbreaking outcomes is the tremendous loss of life. The true number of those who died because of hypothermia or carbon monoxide poisoning could take more time to tally, but already the numbers appear to rival the death toll of Hurricane Harvey back in 2017. Joining us from Dallas is attorney Larry Taylor of the Cochran Law Firm. He represents two families who lost loved ones during the power crisis. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
This is your job, but it's also personal. You grew up with one of the victims that you're representing, Doyle Austin, a former Negro League baseball player who was 95 years old. What happened to him?
Mr. Austin was in his home on Sunday afternoon, lost power. And then Tuesday morning when his family went to check on him and revive him, he was unresponsive. Later on, the emergency service units were called out and they pronounced him dead on the scene. Mr. Austin lived in Acres Home, a place where I grew up, and I used to walk past his house to his sister's house, who was a surrogate grandmother of mine, along with his brother-in-law. So I spent many holidays and birthdays at the home celebrating with Mr. Austin. Mr. Austin was a character. He was well-dressed, and his personality was bigger than life. He encouraged many of us to continue to seek out both athletics and academics. And so he was a pillar of the community as well as a hero to the family.
You're also representing the family of another man who died, Gilbert Rivera. He was 60 years old. The Harris County Medical Examiner found his primary cause of death to be hypothermia. In both of these lawsuits for Rivera and Austin, you named two defendants, ERCOT and CenterPoint Energy. What is your argument in these cases?
Our argument is that they were well aware that these power grids needed to be upgraded and they failed to do so. And so our lawsuit is looking at their failure to act to protect us citizens of Texas.
The Texas Supreme Court is expected to rule sometime before June on whether ERCOT can even be held liable in lawsuits. In the past, sovereign immunity has been a defense. Can you explain how sovereign immunity works?
Sovereign immunity is basically, in this regard, ERCOT taking on the role of a pseudo governmental agency, in the sense that they're acting in on the government's behalf in order to run the electricity. They're saying, because they were in that role, that they are protected from these particular errors. Our argument is that they're not. They had a duty to act in which they failed to do so. And so the lawsuit that is currently pending before the Supreme Court, I do believe, is between an additional energy company, an energy provider. Mm-hmm. So it's a business-to-business lawsuit. However, we believe that even if we had to go that route again, that our lawsuit would be different, in that we're talking about citizens. We're talking about those of us who live in Texas, even myself, who was affected, who were not protected during this storm, and that people lost their lives. And so we believe that while the defendant is the same, the situation is different.
These two families that you're representing, these are just a few of the many calls for help from loved ones who had family members who died during this storm seeking help. Do we even have a true scope of the death toll here?
We don't. Every time I hear a story and I think, well, that was bad, I get a call and it seems to be worse. You have the 11-year-old boy who died. You have children who suffered from carbon dioxide poison from trying to stay warm. You have other elderly individuals who passed away from hypothermia. And the list goes on. And I don't think that we truly have a scope of how bad it is, only because these families are still grieving. And it's really hard to reach out and to call someone like myself when you're still grieving about the fact that you just lost your loved one.
What else do you want state leaders and really the country to know about what happened during this crisis and lessons learned so it doesn't happen another time?
I want them to learn that while we beat our chest and to say that we were independent and Texas is able to take care of itself, I want them to realize that taking care of ourselves means taking care of our citizens, because this affected all the citizens of Texas, you know, especially communities of color and rural communities, because those communities do not get the same care as far as infrastructure. And this is just a continuous issue involving these communities.
Larry Taylor is an attorney with the Cochran Law Firm in Dallas, Texas. Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
And we reached out to the defendants in these lawsuits. CenterPoint Energy said that as a policy, it does not comment on pending litigation. And ERCOT said they are currently reviewing all lawsuits. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.